Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Noom. Forget one-size-fits-all diets. With Noom, you get a personalized weight loss plan that's tailored to your lifestyle. No food is off limits. Enjoy your favorites while discovering healthier habits. Noom's users love the flexible approach, blending psychology and biology to help you lose weight in a way that's sustainable for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's N-O-O-M.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 452. I hope you've had a delightful week, or if you're listening to this at the beginning of the week, I hope you're about to have an amazing week. Yes, I'm in that kind of super upbeat mood right now, so please deal with it. I would like to say that Nerdist News is a show that we've been doing for the past, like, 6 weeks over on the Nerdist channel at youtube.com/Nerdist with Jessica Chobot. We absorbed a lot of really great G4 people over on the Nerdist channel. It was sad to see G4 go, although it still is kind of this weird zombie channel that is being powered by WebSoup. I think the only show they own outright. But Jessica Chobot is hosting a sort of a bite-sized news show for us on the YouTube channel 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. I'm hoping to expand it at some point to 4 or 5 days a week. But she's doing a fantastic job. And people like Dan Casey drop by, and she has guests. And it really is like, I've been calling it G4.1. So go over and check out Nerdist News. Follow them on Twitter, at Nerdist News, and then youtube.com/Nerdist. That's it for that. And I am so excited about the sponsor. I am so excited. I mean, of course, I'm always excited about the sponsors, but I'm particularly excited that we are being sponsored this episode by the new Coen Brothers movie, Inside Llewyn Davis. The Coen Brothers sponsoring a podcast. When I was sitting and watching Raising Arizona 150 times in the 80s, if I ever thought that we would even have this much of a connection to the Coen Brothers, it's not like Joel and Ethan called me and said, hey, can we put this on the podcast? I don't want to make it seem like that. But I'm just glad that that I'm able to even say them in their name in any kind of official capacity. But Inside Llewyn Davis takes place in Greenwich Village as sort of the folk music scene in 1961. It's been nominated for 3 Golden Globe Awards, including Best Motion Picture, Comedy, or Musical. And, of course, it was written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, starring Oscar Isaac, Carey Mulligan's in it, John Goodman, of course, Garrett Hedlund, and then Justin Timberlake makes a little cameo in there as well, and I saw a clip from that, and it actually looks pretty cool. So, Inside Llewyn Davis, check it out, is now playing in select cities, and I'd like to thank, I'm just going to go ahead and thank the Coen Brothers, not for sponsoring this episode of the podcast, but just for...
Oh, are you recording right now?
Yes, why do you think I'm talking loudly into my phone?
I think you're on a conference call.
Yes, I am on a conference call with hundreds of thousands of people.
Hi, hundreds of thousands of people.
It's just that they're not able to talk back. Okay. I mean, they can talk back.
Oh, they'll talk back.
They'll talk back on the comment boards. but they, you know, you could talk back to your podcast if you're listening to it. Just say things back and then just pretend that the rest of us are just talking so fast that you can't get a word in edgewise, but you're forgiving of us because, you know, we're hyperkinetic and we love you. This episode of the podcast is Brendan Small, who I've known for so long, and I have loved watching him attain this incredibly successful thing that he's carved out. He's one of the most talented people you will ever meet. I don't know if you know this or not, but many years ago, and we talk about this in the podcast, Mike Furman and a friend of ours, Lee Farber, and I, and Brendan, all made this thing called the Tron Rock Opera, which is a 12-minute rock opera about the movie Tron. And this was in 2003, before anyone gave a shit about Tron again. So, yeah, I'm going to be a little bit of a Tron hipster right now, is that we did it before it was cool. Well, actually, it was always cool to us. We just loved Tron and wanted to make a rock opera about it. So we'll talk about that in the podcast. But right now, Brendan has a somewhat new album out called Galacticon, a high-stakes intergalactic extreme rock album. And then also, of course, you can go get the Metalocalypse album, Doomstar Requiem, The Clock Opera. So go to brendansmall.com, BrendonSmall.com, and that'll give you links to that and just more stuff about Brendan, who's amazing. And he brought his axe, body spray, and a guitar to play music. So here we go, the Nerds Podcast number 452 with Brendan Small.
Brendan Small! Stick around until the end of the podcast for a special track from Doomstar Requiem. Brendan Small, I'm progress!
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Planning on making that left-handed, or are you just gonna? Because I mean, that'd be easy to restring, but
yeah, all you have to do is restring. Yeah. It. I mean, yeah. What else is there? That, I mean, I guess the knobs are up.
The pot switches and stuff. Because I have a.
Those get in the way, right?
Yeah, I have a casino I've flipped to be like Paul McCartney.
You just switch your arms.
It's harder than you think to do that. Yeah, my thumbs would be on the wrong side.
Now you're just making excuses. I guess you don't want it that bad.
Yeah. You're right.
Brendan Small. Hi, how's it going?
Hey, man.
Thanks for joining us on Guitar Talk.
I'm good, thanks. I'm good. What's going on?
Oh, nothing. Just working.
Doing a little work, right?
What are you up to?
Well, I just finished a whole bunch of stuff, so now I have, free time.
What do you do with free time?
What do I do? I still do music, so I ended up getting roped into doing other music stuff that I didn't foresee, but it's fun. I'm doing a ridiculous cover of... What Does the Fox Say?
Yeah.
With Scott Ian and Brian Posehn.
Of course. That sounds
Brian
about right.
Singing?
Yes, he is. It's really, really fun.
What Does the Fox Say?
Oh, and Corey from Slipknot is... Yeah. And it's it actually sounds really, really good.
Nice.
And the worst thing about doing a cover of What Does the Fox Say is that you have that song stuck in your head.
Even if you didn't do the cover,
if you didn't do this cover, well, I had to listen to the whole song because I had to build a whole beat map because I programmed all the drums for it, and I had never gotten past when the guy makes the old guy is doing the sounds, I never got to the end of the song. But the song is actually it's really well produced.
I've never heard it.
All their stuff is really
don't must have
heard it.
Don't hear it.
I bet you have heard it because I didn't know I heard it until I realized that that's what was playing on Hits 1 on Sirius XM.
Bush song.
This is a. But that's also the chorus of What Does the Fox Say?
Oh, wow.
This is Chris Isaac's name.
Oh, Wicked Game?
Yeah.
It sure is.
What does the fox say? What does the fox do? No, I don't want to be a fox no more.
Just sitting with a guitar.
You know, that's what I do in the morning. Because the thing is, I've put myself in a position where I have to play a lot of guitar, and I have to play it well, and I have to play fast guitar. And I created a show where the guitar player really, really fast, so I got to keep up with that. So every morning I have the same routine where I wake up an hour or two before I have to be anywhere, and I drink coffee, and I play about an hour and 45 minutes of guitar and try to learn all this nerdy stuff that keeps your brain alive. Because if you play guitar, you plateau really quickly. Oh, you go, I know how to do this. And then you're and then the way your hands work, people forget this, but you don't always have it. You have it some days, and some days you don't. You're this big, your hands are these blobs, these amorphous, and you have to be in shape constantly. And if you're on the road, you're playing really well because you've got a guitar in your hand, you're playing a show, and the stakes are high, so you got to really not miss notes or screw up or any of that stuff. So I just try to keep my hands in shape every morning.
What do you immediately start playing when you pick it up?
Let's see. There's three chords. Yeah. And... like part of a eruption, which I blow.
Sorry, Brendan, you just
started out.
That was a much better joke.
Stuff, but that wasn't even good. Eddie Van Halen would probably sneer at that. But the guitar players listening, like, know that I blew half of that. So, but it sounded like nobody knows. Nobody can tell. That's the great thing about guitar.
If it's distorted enough, no one can tell.
It's true. Yeah.
Is it so fun when it's like a chore sort of, where it's like I have to do this every day?
You know what really sucks? I find is recording rhythm guitars for metal songs. So that is. It's all about the right hand, about getting your right hand. You have to just, not only do you have to record it once, you have to record it twice, because like in a Metallica song or something like that, it's not just one rhythm guitar you're hearing, it's two, and they're panned hard left and hard right. But James Hetfield is such a good rhythm guitar player that he, you know... So even that was like, it sounded okay, but if you have to strip that and play along with it with another guitar, then things start getting really crazy. So things like that.
Do you have forearm cramps?
I do.
You know, only when I play bar chords on an acoustic is when my hand really starts cramping up. But I know when I'm playing the best guitar I'm playing, it's when my hand is usually pretty warm and loose and I'm not pressing hard, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, if you're playing tennis or jogging, you want to flex every muscle when you're running. You want to keep it loose and be able to kind of be in control. So,
Well, I remember. Let's go back a ways.
Let's go in the old time machine.
Let's go back in the old. Rip. Oh, can I have a time machine? Rip cord or something?
Yeah.
Like just some time machine?
A good time machine.
Good.
Yeah, that's good.
So here we are in like 2003.
Yeah, maybe around then. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like 2003. I first met you kind of just around the LA comedy scene.
Sure.
And I did not know at that time that you were a guitar player. I knew that you had done home movies.
Right. Yeah.
And we were doing a lot of the same fun/crappy shows around Los Angeles.
Sure. I think I remember we would do the old comedy Death Ray at the time.
That was a fun show.
That was a great show. What's that?
It was just the Tuesday night show at M-Bar.
Yeah, it was just the Tuesday, which is one of the best shows, and that venue was one of the best venues, and those guys packed it really well, and it was always a cool drop-in. And I remember then there's the other ones, like the Brew...
Brewco.
Yeah, the Brewco. Do they still do those shows?
No, it just ended.
Really?
This year, it just ended.
I never got on. They never drew my name.
You could go on now.
I could probably go to anyone else. Do as much time as you want. Those are great shows. I remember doing stand-up. Somebody said, hey, you got to come and do my show. It was around that era. And it was at the Comedy Store in the upstairs room.
The belly room.
And he said, you got to come. It's a great show. Just be there at like 5:30. And I was like, 5:30? That's early for comedy. And I went there, and there were like 35 comics. And I was the last one there, or maybe they drew names and I was the last person. But one by one, each comic, who is the audience also, you forget in comedy that the audience is you. You and your peers are the audience. So you're performing for your peers 90% of the time when you're working on stuff. And by the time each guy finished and they said, good night, and then they left and they'd go straight to their car. And by the time it got to me, I was the last one there, except for the host who was sitting there with his arms crossed with a big smile on his face.
Yeah.
Like, ladies and gentlemen, Brendan Small. And he ran back down.
Well, that was always the first big jump when you went from open mic comic to like, oh, you're starting to get on booked shows.
Right, yeah.
And then some of the open mics would go, oh, you could drop in whenever you want. You go, oh, I've got a free pass.
Yeah, it must be somebody.
And then they would put you on last and call you the headliner, and then you realize, no, I'm just the guy going last.
I'm the guy going last, but there's nobody there. But I remember I was like, this is, at some point, I don't know if this has happened to all you guys, but you just reach a level of mania and lunacy where you're just like, what the hell is going on? What am I doing? What am I doing just in general with, who am I?
Yeah.
Like all those questions start going, and you have a microphone in your hand, there's one guy with his arms folded in the back of the room. He doesn't want to be that close to you because he's too intimate.
No.
Yeah. And but I just did my act. I probably had the most fun I've ever had in my life, which I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but that was the...
We'll check with that guy.
But that he left. That was the worst part.
Did you come out of the Chicago... You came out of the Chicago comedy scene?
No, I was in Boston. So I went to music school at Berklee College of Music, and then right when I graduated, I got a job in retail, and I started doing comedy.
Where in Boston were you?
I was at the Hong Kong. So Eugene Merman and I became friends during my last year of music school, and he said, we need a roommate. Do you want to be my roommate, him and his buddy Matt? And I said, sure. And he was, I'd already seen him because I'd been in a sketch troupe and stuff. So we ended up doing a Friday night show together, he, myself, and Patrick Borelli, who is now on Fallon and stuff. So the three of us had a show, and we would just do these absurd characters and stand-up and sketches and music things and all kinds of stuff like that. So it was all Boston.
How did you get Home Movies on...
Well, I was on a show. It was at that same club. It's called the Hong Kong if you're in Boston ever. It's a really, really great room. It's always got the best energy in the world. Yeah. And Rick Jenkins was and still is the guy. So every time I'm in town, I go and just I want to go see a show or something, and he drags me on stage and I'm doing something. But I was on a show, and Ron Lynch, who I'd seen come through town a few times, was on the show too, and I had this idea for this character that I wanted to do, and I roped Ron Lynch into doing something with me. But Louis C.K., who I'd seen, he always came to this little club also. And back then, before he was like super famous, he was still the funniest guy in stand-up.
Yeah.
Like, people could say, oh, yeah, he got really, when he became a father, he was way funnier than everybody else in the world, and you laughed until your face hurt long before he had kids or like got married and divorced and all that stuff. But so I was on a show with those two guys, and the guys from Dr. Katz were there too. And I kind of knew which table they were at, so I was doing this ridiculous character kind of to that table, because I was like, I think those guys are the guys, because me and Eugene were like, I know Dr. Katz is done around here, and we love the show, and I know they book comics on that, so we've been doing it for about 8 months. Why not us, you know? And so I got a call from the now creator of Bob's Burgers, Lauren Bouchard. And he was like in his 20s still back then, and then we just like met up and just started putting the show together and improvising. So they would just put me in front of a microphone, and they said, "Be a character or something." And that was how the show developed. It's just recording and improvising and stuff.
And then sort of backing the music into it.
And then, I had my guitar one day, and I just thought we should mess around with some stuff. There was like the second episode of the show, and I started doing like I think I just started playing like. So it was like we were messing around with rock and metal and stuff. So they were playing Ozzy, and I thought, well, there should be a character that plays it. So there was a character on the show that we kind of created, named Dwayne, because of just my love for guitar and stuff. And that was around the same time I didn't know what I was going to do with music after music school. So I kind of had my guitar in its case, and it was collecting dust. So every once in a while, I'd bring it out for like. I'd write little miniature rock operas even back then at the comedy studio, and I didn't know what I was going to do, so I figured, someday I'll do something more than that. So I just play it. There's like a lot of guitar and sloppiness all over Home Movies and stuff, and kind of indie kind of style stuff.
Because when I saw you, it was like Captain Mustache.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You're the Captain
I
Mustache.
I love Captain.
Yeah. Yeah. He's still around.
Yeah, yeah.
He's still around. He's
hey,
still.
Hey, what are those guys over there?
You never know.
Not very good guys.
Yeah.
Why would I try to watch a movie with their cell phone? They could keep checking turn it off.
And the idea he was a Boston comic that was supposed to be a guy that was going to hit but never did.
He was a guy that actually in the story of this character, he was pretty big for a while, but he never got out of Boston. So he influenced all these people. But then, like in the 80s, there was a lot of people that I got to see when I was starting out in the late 90s in Boston who were really funny comics, but I think they'd kind of been away from it for a while, and they were getting back up on stage. So there were like all the old favorites were there, and they're totally hilarious and make you laugh and can run a room like nobody's business. But some of them were kind of like they had been out for a while, and they'd kind of lost their mind on coke and, on just booze, and this before everyone kind of recovered and everything. But that was kind of my impression of that thing that was happening to people. And I love Boston. I love Boston comics. And then it's kind of also my impression of my father trying to tell a joke. And just blowing it and just forgetting
so
it.
Your dad was a big stand-up in the 80s.
Yeah.
In the 90s, he was still trying to make
I think he may think he was. I always like to say that every once in a while when people are really funny. You know what you should do? You should try stand-up and see what it's really like bombing.
My brother's really funny.
You should try it.
You should try it.
You, give it a
you
try.
Should really try it.
Perform for one guy.
Yeah.
Night after
go
night.
And, yeah. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
What is music school like? And do you was it is it a good experience for a young musician to actually go to a focused
I think it's cool. I think if you want to have some kind of a like luckily I had a small understanding of what I wanted out of music school, which I think a lot of people don't like almost in any college. Like they don't know what they want. But I knew that I wanted to get into the I wanted to get into composition. I wanted to learn how to write music and be able to find it faster and be able to understand just to be able to label things quickly. So we all like there are amazing musicians who don't read music and don't know theory or anything, but their ears are really well developed because they listen to great music their whole life and they just can kind of identify things. They don't know the names of all that stuff that they're identifying, but they're picking it out and they'll sit behind a guitar long enough and they'll come up with a beautiful melody or, you know, the stuff that they've learned in the past, like if they listen to Queen and stuff like that, that'll kind of turn up in their music because they've heard all these chords.
That's what Mike Ferman's like. He never had formal training.
But he's a great musician.
But he can spot.
Yeah.
You know, like he was the guy.
Yeah.
I think he sort of takes it for granted. Like, oh, yeah, most people just don't pick things up and then just start playing stuff they hear.
Yeah.
And he'll go, oh, yeah, I know, I think it's this. Here it
he's
is.
He's got a great ear. Yeah. The guy,
he's
gets
a super
it.
Ear because he has yeah. no sense of smell.
That's right.
Oh, he has to right. make up for it by hearing things.
He smells with his ears.
Yeah, he smells,
he smells music with his ears.
Yeah, his ear smelling. Yeah. But he is great, and I've always noticed that about him. And you never did you study or
no?
Yeah, but you're a natural musician too.
Not really.
Yeah, you are.
You got the voice.
Yeah, you got a good voice. That's
you got
hard
that
to
melodica.
Do. You got the melodica.
The melodica.
But you have. I mean, but some people, it's then you're lucky because if you're not trying that. But everyone, even like really great people, have to try really hard and still make it good. But when I was in music school, I realized that. All the composition classes and arranging classes I took would end up paying off at some point. And you end up kind of just having a favorite group of things that you like, you know? Like if I have an old Queen song that I like, I try to figure out, oh, why do those chords sound like that? What are they doing? So I'll go and try to analyze that. And then through music school analysis, you kind of understand what they're doing, you know?
That's right. I remember you and I went to a Halloween party one year in like, I don't know, it might have been like 02 maybe or 03, but we went to Padgett Brewster's house.
Oh, yeah.
And we were in the car, and you had Night at the Opera,
which is yeah,
and I had Night at the Opera, but I hadn't listened to it in a long time. And you're like,
yeah.
Oh, and you're like, we gotta listen to this. Like we parked the car, and then we just listened to Prophet song.
Yeah,
and I hadn't really really listened to it, which is now since then. Has become one of my all-time favorite songs, and the whole time you're explaining, like he just locked himself in the studio, and then just like added all these. And I just never had really paid attention to it before, but it's a
that's one of the
fucking shocking piece of music.
It really is one of the best. People ask me, like, even in the world of metal, because a lot of metal people, sometimes they don't listen outside of metal, but the guys that do, like, listen. Like, even Metallica, they have this Ennio Morricone kind of background and all these different things, like film score and this grandiosity about them and this epicness about them. But Brian May, like, those guys were studied musicians who studied classical music and all that stuff. And then, oh, he was also, what... astrophysicist or whatever, you know, all this stuff. But he completely understands. That song is one of the most epic, big songs. It's about the end of the world, too, which is always a good topic. And he was, I think there was, he talks about it in one of those, you know, those when they take the record and they...
Do
they,
the doc on the record.
Yeah, do like, the documentary.
It's on Netflix usually. Like, well, they're,
classic
they're
album
Netflix
series,
now.
That's what
yeah,
it is.
Yeah,
so they have like the Steely Dan version. And they have like all the nerdy, and then they have the Queen one, so I bought that one, and Brian May talks about the Prophet song. And he said, I wanted to write a song for, like, 15-year-old boys to, like, because it's about basically Dungeons and Dragons and the end of the world and then cool guitars and this big crazy etude that happens in the middle with Freddie Mercury's vocal.
It's fucking nuts, especially when you think about how people had to record music.
That way, it was archaic. They had to, like, they had tape, and that was it. And they had to bounce, like, 8 guitars onto one thing. And if you screw that up, you have to start over again, you know? And they would have to run the tape around the room because they were, and then put a flange on. I know they put, like, headphones in a coffee can to get that old-timey sound on, like, Good Company, that song with, you know. Anyway, they did so much cool stuff. Roy Thomas Baker, that's the producer. Just a lunatic madman who just made that album work. That thing holds up like crazy.
And yet, so we listened to that song, and then, yeah. And then I was just, and then I was addicted to that song.
Yeah.
For months.
Yeah, it's a great one. A lot of people don't know about that because everyone knows Bohemian Rhapsody off of Night at the Opera and like You're My Best Friend and stuff like that. But not everyone knows about the Prophet song. I covered that song with the School of Rock kids one time.
Oh shit!
And so I had like three guitarists, and we learned all the whole thing, and they had like six vocalists. And then we did rounds. So, oh, wow. The earth will shake.
The earth will shake. The earth will shake.
Yeah. Death all around, around.
Death all around, 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 around.
So we had that all the way, and it was pretty crazy. But it ended up working. It was really cool.
That's really cool.
Sometimes that's all you want to do is just start a cover band and play your favorite songs that never existed.
Oh, yeah. Every day. Yeah. There's so many songs where I'm like, oh, I just want to cover that in a weird. I just want to cover that weird.
You have covered crazy songs.
We have covered crazy songs. Yeah. So when you and I first started talking, it was. I remember it was at El Cid. And Furman and I, we're doing Hard and Firm stuff, and then
right,
and we did a, you know, we did whatever it was that we were doing at the time, and then you came up afterwards, and you were like, "Hey, I don't know if you, I knew you was a comic, I didn't know you was a musician," and you're
right.
Like, "Look, I'm a guitar player, and you know, I have a little home studio thing, and you know, if you guys ever want to come do something, it'd be really fun."
Yeah.
And it was so long ago that I remember I brought like a 12-pack of beer to your house. That's how long ago it was, and I probably drank all of it, but.
I don't remember that part, but I do remember you guys showing up.
You drank it really fast.
Yeah, you were living in Silver Lake.
I was living in Los Feliz, I remember, yeah.
Oh, on Rodney, right?
Yeah, on Rodney.
Right up the street from Wacko.
Right up the street from Wacko, yeah.
And so you said the magic words to us, which was, always wanted to do a rock opera about Tron.
Yeah.
Now, my
my
history with that movie... Like, we instantly bonded.
You mean magic words to close a vagina.
Yes. Yes, go on.
No. You have to get your information disc and then break the wall down so that you can bury the information disc right at the case if you want to get into the master control
dental
pussy.
Disc.
Oh, nice. So, because Mike and I were huge fans of Tron, and I'd always been a huge fan of Tron, and at that time... No one else was really a huge fan of Tron. Like, it hadn't resurged.
We were ahead of the time.
It was so... Because Disney had considered that movie a complete failure. And even on the DVD of Tron, they get stuff about the movie wrong. Like, they say, Flynn's quest to take down the Master Control Panel. It was not the Master Control Program. Anyway, you should know that if you're fucking putting out the DVD.
They had the old trailers. I remember, I think the first time I saw it, and I go and check this out. Maybe someone else can call in. I know this is not a live, but at some point after this is aired.
Just call, Chris.
But I think I saw a trailer, and the voiceover said, "In a world." I swear to God. In a world.
Computers?
It was like this old vaudevillian.
You want to get sucked in?
Yeah. They got blue. They got red.
Yeah. They got every color.
Ultimately, what we all did was to write a 12-minute rock opera about Tron.
Yeah.
And, which we never recorded.
Yeah. Oh, we started...
Yeah.
I saw this like where did it go? It was, I saw it, I think, almost every time they did it.
So it really is all the movements of Tron.
Yeah.
And there's like six different pieces of music in it. You started. You're the first vocal. It's like, I am a scientist. So strong. Yeah.
So,
and then it's all about breaking down the orange in the thing where it's like
watch it disappear. Ooh, it's no longer here. I remember this right now.
It's inside the computer now. Yeah, and it all these words like, you know, our warehouse size hard drive holds 16K. There's all these dumb computer jokes. And then it just basically goes through all the movements of Tron.
We should record that.
And I would love to, because we did it. It was you and me and Furman and then our friend Lee Farber, who wrote for The Soup.
Right.
Who played drums. And so we got the song down, and we started performing it around town, which is a very big undertaking, because most comedy shows are just basically one microphone and a PA, and that's it.
And it was before any theater spaces were doing.
Yeah, it was like
shows.
Fake Gallery and M Bar and places like that. So we would come in with this whole band set up, drums and everything.
We had a projector at M Bar once.
Well, we brought a fucking CRT television
set. I'm not
gonna
lie, I would be so mad. That's right. I would be so mad
as another performer.
Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Well,
it wasn't like an open mic.
The original stage at M Bar 2 was very small, so it was like we were all crammed. And so we basically cut a version of the movie into 13 minutes to play along, so because people couldn't really.
Why don't you guys record it and then we'll just animate it?
We could do that for our YouTube channel.
We should totally
make it. But it was so much fun, and we never got a good recording of it. And then we did it like 6 times, and Furman and I were like, oh my God, we're gonna tour this all over the world. And Brendan, because he's a music prodigy, was like, oh, I'm gonna go. I think I want to do something else. You did it. Like, we did it like 6 times, and you're like, we got it.
Oh yeah. We should record it.
I would love to.
I think shortly thereafter, I started getting into Metalocalypse. I think I sold the show, and I think I just kind of disappeared into a studio for 7 years, which is what I have been doing. Yeah.
Well, I remember, speaking of, you know, when he lived down the street from Wacko, I ran into Brendan at Wacko, and he had just a stack of heavy metal books.
Oh, that's like, right. Yeah, I had, like, I think I had just, maybe I got the church burning one, the Norwegian Lords of Chaos. I think I needed to just kind of check out everything that was just... Because, you know, my whole relationship with metal is I grew up listening to it. And when you play guitar in suburbia, you're going to cross paths with metal. You're going to... That was like the first thing I ever learned. I hadn't even heard the song.
Kids today think that song is made for Iron Man, the movie.
they think it's, yeah. But that was the first thing I learned was just that power chord shape.
But I don't know why, but Furman and I always used to sing lyrics to that song. We'd go,
nobody likes me.
So you learn metal, and then I grew up on like Andrew Lloyd Webber and all that stuff around my house too. So Jesus Christ Superstar and Evita were always playing, and then I listened to King Diamond, and there was a very short distance between Andrew Lloyd Webber and King Diamond. It's just the guitars were louder and there were double kicks and he was doing 1,000 voices. And he was telling stories, though, with his music. So King Diamond is from Denmark, and he's this. He had a band called Merciful Fate first. And metalheads just go insane for him whenever you... And we got him to do voices on Metalocalypse,
too. Oh, no way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was amazing. I called him at home. I think I maybe told you this story on your podcast. So King Diamond is like this Danish evil... the Prince of Darkness from Denmark, and I got his number through like Metallica's management or something.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And they gave it to me, and I said, "Hey, I've got to get in touch with King Diamond. I think he'd be great as a voiceover guy. I mean, this whole show is about honoring metal and all that stuff. I think he'd be the perfect voiceover guy because he can do like a million different voices." And I said, "Okay, here's the number." And I said, "Well, what do you call him when you don't call him King Diamond? Like, he's not really a king, is he?"
He's a king of diamonds.
Is he king of diamonds? he plays cards. That's why.
That's yeah.
But she said, "I don't know. I don't know what to call him." So I got his number, and he like lives in Texas or something.
Jesus.
And I was like, "King Diamond in Texas? That doesn't make any sense." And I called, and I just called. I remember it ringing, and I hear someone say, "Hello." And I said, is King Diamond there? Yes, one moment. Hello, this is King Diamond. How you doing? And it was like, yeah. This is the friendliest, nicest guy in the world. I mean, you realize all these people in comedy and music are all like a bunch of silly carnival barkers trying to lure someone over. Check this out. You know, it's a person with a beard or whatever it is, you know. But he was super cool. And so that's the thing is, and that's what kind of led me to the project that I just did with Metalocalypse, was all that stuff from rock opera stuff to storytelling stuff to the metal stuff. So I got into all this metal stuff. And then in music school, you get all confused about what you like, because you start taking country guitar labs and all kinds of like crazy shit where you're like doing all, you know, like
I had a brief flirtation with rockabilly.
So like the Chet Atkins style. Yeah. So you take all these different kind of labs and you're trying to figure out.
Do any metal songs translate over to country, or are the riffs just too different?
Well, Chet Atkins, Mr. Sandman's
pretty good. Chet Atkins is pretty good. But yeah, you know what? They're flat picking stuff. They're like super like crazy. They have really amazing flat pickers back in the old like.
Was that Daddy's Junkie Music?
Yeah,
there on Mass Ave.
There's an old there's a place kind of like the Guitar Center before Guitar Center owned everything. There was a place called Daddy's Junkie Music. Right,
well,
across
Guitar Center took it over. I love still when I go to Boston. Like I'll be there this weekend. I will go into that store and just listen to the kids coming in, like,
oh yeah,
yeah, and like, because they'll always be like, they'll always be looking for whatever guitar is of the style they're trying to, like, they're like, oh, we're doing flat picking and I need a Telecaster, like,
right,
it's always,
yeah,
and
you'll,
I really
you'll
enjoy
hear the
it.
Same the thing is, like, time is frozen inside of that place. It's mm-hmm. still where every single guitar riff kind of goes to live, like. Hear all those riffs that never die. Yeah, all that stuff.
Were you a Jerry Reed fan at all?
I knew his guitar playing, and he was a great guitar player, but I didn't go deep into his world, but he's awesome.
It's pretty. And then Lindsey Buckingham is a guy that
he's great, and Lindsey Buckingham is like.
I play like him because
he plays, I mean, he. Plays with a pick, you know, it's pretty amazing. Jeff Beck's the same way. Mm-hmm. Jeff Beck's just...
Can you do classical guitar at all, or is that a whole different discipline?
It's a different. Doesn't sound that great on this.
Could you take down Ralph Macchio? I want him to take down Ralph Macchio at the Crossroads.
Oh, that one. Oh, I don't think I could do that right now. I think it's fantastic. Satriani. I was into Satriani there.
Summer Song, one of my favorite songs of all time.
But that's something about Metalocalypse, too, is I got in touch with all my guitar heroes. Well, not all of them, but a lot of them. So Satriani and Steve Vai came and did voices, and Billy Gibbons came and did voices.
Yeah,
and
that's awesome.
They're all great. And, you know, the guys from the world of the metal, from like Cannibal Corpse to Metallica to, they all love comedy. They're all comedy. You probably have learned this as you've met tons.
Oh, yeah, musicians always, there's definitely this sort of symbiotic, like,
yeah.
We as comics want to be rock stars, and rock stars want to be funny. Like, there's this sort of like, there is this sort of mutual, like, oh, that's all, how do you do that?
Yeah.
And they're going, oh, fuck, how do you
We're living each other's dreams.
I know, but a comic, like, you know, when you just have a microphone on stage and everything's working, you're in complete control, that's where a musician goes, I got to drag a drum kit around.
Yeah.
You know, kind of reaction everywhere.
I mean, they're pretty much the same, except in comedy, there's less money and sex.
Yeah, I don't know. Music's taking a big nosedive, guys.
Or the sex.
There's still
not
sex,
the money.
Yeah. No, you'll get. You realize there's someone with low enough self-esteem to have sex with you out there.
Yeah. Oh,
everyone, every venue. Us. Yeah.
AMLO,
yeah.
America. Yeah.
If you want even less self-esteem, they'll fuck a comedian.
Yeah.
There's that. when Fleetwood Mac did the reunion in '97 and they did the dance, and Lindsey Buckingham comes out and plays Big Love by himself.
Right.
And he's fucking. It's like there's three bottom fingers are picking, but then with his thumb he's playing the bass at the same time.
Yeah.
Where it's almost like classical rock thing at the same time.
That's the thing about guitars. You know, pretty much everyone at this table has a guitar somewhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But to play like four or five notes and to know who the guitarist is,
yeah,
is amazing. Like Lindsey Buckingham has his own voice on the instrument. Plus, he's a great songwriter. He has a great singing voice and all that stuff. And Fleetwood Mac's amazing. It wouldn't be the same without him. But yeah, how does a person develop a style?
Because I was, you know, with a comedy voice at least, like, oh, you use your words. But with a guitar, you know, I guess.
Yeah, when you're a comedian, there's like no one in competition. When, you know, there's no one really in competition with what you're doing when you're doing a personal story on stage. No one did that, just you. So no one can be on guitar. Everyone can grab. But I notice it's with vibrato. So. Like getting that right vibrato to make it sound like Angus Young, getting that faster kind of a thing that he does, or you know, that doesn't sound like Brian May really, because he actually. That vibrato is totally wrong, but I'm trying my best to make it sound like him, but it's not working.
You're using tone, yeah. You're using tone, and then like whatever sort of pedals they have, and then
it's
and then
that. But you know, it's really funny. It took me like 20 years of guitar playing to realize that a good guitar plugged into a good amp is what everyone's got, and everything else is your fault. It's like this guy or this guy not talking to each other. You know, everything else is your fault. You have to like make that sad realization, because guitar players, we buy into that idea that there's a piece of gear out there that's going to make you sound good.
Pedal chasers.
But what else are you going to do? Yeah, you know, you want to. Like,
oh, you're talking to the right guy.
What am I going to just like? Who doesn't go on eBay and fantasize about stupid crap they want to like? My girlfriend's looking at shoes, while I'm looking at like pedals and boutique nerdy amps. Or yeah, like, oh, it's my speaker cone. No, it's this. But Jeff Beck plays out of a little tiny like Tweed amp for, you know, 8,000 people, yeah. And just makes the thing sing, and yeah. He doesn't even have a pick or anything. He's got a guitar cable. That's his only extra thing.
I remember when you were developing, it was right around the same time you probably ran into Jonah at Wacko with
right.
the books, but you know, at the time you would also go, you'd say like, have you ever heard Cannibal Corpse? Like, I want to do something like that.
Yeah.
But it's like, but you can't understand any of the words.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you went and fucking Apocalypse,
yeah.
Which, is it mind-bendy at all that... You know, that in that genre of music, which you were essentially paying homage to and in some sense is satirizing, it's like
sure.
Now you're the, like, your album, that you have the most successful selling.
Oh, yeah, it was like the highest charting, I think, was the thing. Is we charted higher than any other metal or extreme metal, death metal, I think, in that specific genre. We're the number one death metal cartoon band of all time. No one can take that away.
Not one other death metal cartoon?
No, there's not one other one. Well, there's one. But they sold like one less record than us.
It's the Chipmunks.
I realized, yeah, if you make your category so specific, no one can ever compete with that either.
Well, that's true, but people do. But you do.
But like, people do like no for some reason. Well, here's the thing: is you know, we were messing around with music, and I was kind of getting back into the idea of being a guitar player, kind of in addition to being a comedy writer and a showrunner and all that stuff. But I wanted to. When I had an opportunity to put the first record out, I thought, how many opportunities am I going to get? This should sound good. The music should be something you'd actually, in addition to this silly world that we've created, it should be something that you'd want to actually hear. You know, you want to get to the end. How many songs have you listened to where you're like, I don't need to hear that, where that goes? I don't need to hear that. I get the idea. It's music. The guy's playing drums and you're singing some crappy melody. And who cares about any of that stuff? So the idea is, how do you make it, how do you want to, how do you put something in your CD player that you don't want to take out? Like, what is that? You know, and how do you get to that to writing music that makes you want to leave a CD in your CD player?
Well, especially with comedy, and it's sort of the
and that's ancient talk CD player, by the way.
But yeah. but the idea
your flash
of,
drive, yeah.
The idea of finding the thing that ultimately that you do, like the thing that sort of puts your stamp on the world, is you know kind of asking yourself like what are all the things that I like to do and taking other disciplines and mashing them together to create something that no one's really seen before. I mean, like, you know, one of the big things like when Tenacious D first came around was comedy bands up to that point were, you know, There's a bathroom on the right. You know, it was that. Yeah. And there wasn't really, it wasn't music that, like you said, that you'd want to listen to. But then, oh my God, they can fucking, he can sing.
He can sing
and
like
they sound
crazy.
Amazing.
Yeah. And their music writing is outstanding. Yeah. There's really strong.
And
those guys
also
are great musicians.
Like,
and then it's funny
two,
on top of that. But they're also these guys that have the power of like 1,000 people that are plugged in with these two acoustic guitars. It's just amazing. They're just, they have so much. Jack Black's voice is great.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I think I was, that's what I was wondering, because, you know, you do see guys with acoustic guitars doing parody stuff on stage every once in a while. Or at least I saw that when I was starting out, and I thought, this is really making me laugh, and it's actually really funny, but I don't want to do that. I want to do something else, and it's going to be, I think it's going to involve me plugging this thing in, and that's going to be part of the difference. So that's where Metalocalypse also came from. Plus, the other thing you were saying is finding something that you like and you're kind of interested in. It's really stupid because I was just talking about Cannibal Corpse and talking about metal and like all these Norwegian and all these black metal bands and stuff. And I had, and I was in the middle, I think I'd sold a show to the Sci-Fi Network, like an animated thing. And I was just complaining about like how long it's taken and just all kinds of crap. And my buddy from the Venture Brothers, Chris McCulloch, said, I don't understand. You're sitting here, you're complaining about this show. That sounds like it's funny and it's probably going to work, but... But all you realize, I don't know if you realize this, but all you're saying, all you're talking about is Cannibal Corpse. Why don't you make a show about that? And I was like, I can't believe. I stood there and just like was like, I can't believe you had to tell me that.
Well,
that's exactly what I said. I was like, I just had no idea that.
But that's the
that
thing.
That's what I've been talking about the whole time.
That's the thing is that sometimes you don't have the right perspective on stuff, and when you think about work, I think it's a function of the generation that we grew up in, where our parents. Our parents' generation was sort of like, well, work is this, and it's a thing that you do that you have to do, and play is your own hobby, and you keep that separate.
Yeah.
And because for me, it was the same thing when I started all the Nerdist stuff. I was like,
sure. Oh,
wait a minute. What if I actually worked on stuff that I cared about?
Right, you know?
And it does sound like a, well, of course, that's so simple. Why wouldn't you do that? But it really doesn't occur to you at first because the things you like are so close to your heart that you don't think, oh, that should be my job. I just didn't intuitively think that.
So what got you to that? How'd you get to that place? Is just you
getting
just
kicked in the face by the business for 15 years or 12 or 13 years, whatever
email
it was.
Came on January 9th, 2010.
Yeah, I mean, it really was just time and time again of like, oh man, I lost another job or this thing didn't get picked up, and I didn't really care that much about it to begin with, but I still feel bad about it. And I think just kind of going, I think I just want to take ownership over it, and I only want to work on stuff I care about. At least that way,
right?
Even if I can just scrape by,
sure.
At least I will be happy because I'm doing stuff that I care about.
That's great. Yeah, that's a tough one to. That's a tough one to figure out. That thing that you're like, what am I interested in saying?
Most people don't know. Most people.
It's hard to do. You have to keep talking until you say it.
Well, most people don't even know what they want to say, nor do they know what they want. Like if you said, what do you want? People go, I don't know, more of something.
When you were introducing the Metalocalypse rock opera at
the premiere.
You started talking about, like, you started with telling a story about sitting around with Eugene.
Oh, and that's, it kind of is the same conversation, So I went and, I just, because we'd all work so hard and putting an animated show together, it's just tons of hours of just waiting for renders to finish, and everyone's working really hard, and they can really go home if they want to. They don't have to put the extra hours in, but they all started really, particularly on this project, really started giving a shit even more. Like all the compositors and animators and people were just like, I'm sticking around just in case you need me. I'm gonna be eating pizza in the back, but if something fucks up, you come and get me. And you're like, you are allowed to go home, you're not getting paid for this. We ran out of money a long time ago. But they all really cared, and it was really nice too. And then they all just like they were all so good. The team had gelled so well this for this particular project that I wanted to say something nice to him up top. And I think we're also doing a 1 hour rock opera animated special was something I hadn't seen before, and it reminded me of back when I had started out, just started getting on stage with Eugene and doing a comedy night with him. And I remember us walking to or from the venue to our house that we lived in. And we just saw all these comics, and we just thought, we're lucky enough to get stage time kind of whenever we want it. And the question for us is, what are we doing? What are we doing now that we have the microphone in our face? What are we saying? And I see so many people where I can guess the punchline of the joke before it happens, or it's a thing, or it's another thing. But it may not be for me. I was like, I don't know if it's gonna be stand up or it's gonna be something creative. And this is like pre home movies. But I thought, and we just kind of made this pact that like, as long as we do something, we should make sure it's not something else. So it should be the thing doing like, what are you gonna do when you get there? Do something different.
Right.
Doesn't matter what it is. Just do something different.
Right.
And you may end up starting a business that no one else can start because you're the only you out there. You know. So. Then I said, hey, tonight we're going to do something I hadn't seen before, which is a one-hour rock opera with the 50-piece orchestra and the lead singer from Cannibal Corpse singing with me, and then Malcolm McDowell and Mark Hamill singing also, and Jack Black singing, and great vocalists and musicians all around, and just putting this thing into a big, crazy thing that actually went back to everything that I'd grown up on, from Tommy to Jesus Christ Superstar to... the metal stuff to King Diamond to all that stuff, all kind of wrapped into one little thing. So
yeah, it was great.
Does it ever freak you out at all?
Doing all that stuff?
Well, just freak you out in the sense of like,
I got to do everything I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? It's funny because I think I created a job for myself that's kind of the ultimate job for me. But there's don't worry, you'll always be dissatisfied and want something else.
I knew it.
Yeah, don't worry. That's always there, guys.
What am I going to do if I fulfill all my dreams and then I should ostensibly be happy?
Yeah, what are you going to do, right? But don't worry, that doesn't happen.
Oh, good.
It's not just a hole, it's an endless pit.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's funny because I was doing tons of comedy when I started out. I was still doing the Tomorrow Show with Ron Lynch and Craig Anton every weekend. And I was doing tons and tons of stand up. Then I started doing the records and the touring. So I just all my time went away. But now, like over the last year, I've been going out and doing stand up again. And it's really funny how slack those muscles can get if you're not up on stage every night. I bombed like so hard. I went and did a show in Brooklyn, and it was just so uncomfortable and long. It was amazing. It was such a long trip home back from that thing. And I was like, right, right. And then I was like, well, that's not why I didn't. I think the last big comedy show I'd done before, it was like a 40-minute set where I'd improvised half of it. And it was like, oh, here I am. I can do whatever I want. But then later on I went back and I just sucked terribly.
Well, you know what happens is that when you – it's, you know, as a comic, one of the greatest things that can happen is that people come see you on purpose. And then all of a sudden you're performing for your tribe.
Right.
Which is great.
Right.
But what happens is you get a little spoiled.
Yeah.
So then when you go guest on someone else's show where people didn't come to see you,
right,
that's where it's like, oh, right, I have to be a comic. I can't just be me.
Right.
And people aren't just going to accept that because they don't know and they don't give a shit.
You have to like show up. You have to be confident and have material ready to go.
But it's good to have
and,
those experiences.
But that was, it was so good. I remembered every single thing I had ever done in my life has always been prefixed with a major failure and an embarrassment at the top. Like my first real guitar playing in front of people, I was 15 years old and I was in a guitar competition that my stupid friend talked me into because I think he talked me into it because I was just a little bit worse than him, so there's no way he could come in last place. But I sucked so horribly that night. It was like a 3 to 5 minute piece, and I was so nervous. My hands didn't work, and it was just terrible. I remember my sister was in the audience and with her cheerleader friends, and I was sitting there just really like
for the cheerleaders. And in front of you.
It was like when Marty McFly's hands started disappearing.
It was like that, but my hands were there, so I didn't have an excuse. If I were Marty McFly, I can't play guitar, and my hands are disappearing.
You didn't have the excuse like the space-time continuum because his father's going to meet the wrong woman.
Exactly. I didn't have that excuse going for me. But I went home, and I remember just like I had like this moment with my guitar after humiliating myself. After, you know, in school, people go, what are you doing on the weekends? I go, I play guitar. I go, really? Yeah, and I would play it for you right now, but there's no guitar. So you're going to have to take my word for it. Then everyone finally came and saw me play guitar, and I was the worst guitarist in the world.
So what do you do on the weekend?
Yeah. nice guitar playing. It was terrible. Like, from anybody's point of view, it was like, that is some bad guitar playing. And I remember I flipped open my case, and I looked at my guitar, and I looked at my hands, and I thought, what happened out there, guys? We can't experience this again. This is bad. You know, this is really, really. I don't think it's gotten this bad before. This is about the worst it's ever been.
We've been together for 15
I know,
years, guys.
I know. But yeah. And I was just like, between you and me, and then like I didn't factor in that the playing in front of people was gonna rack my nerves and caused lactic acid to build up and seize my joints or whatever it was. But I remember thinking, like, you know, the 2 weeks that I practiced before this were the 2 weeks I've ever, the hardest practicing I'd ever done. I woke up at like 4 a.m. I practiced before school. I stayed up. I got like 2 hours of sleep for 2 weeks. But something happened where I noticed some major improvement, where I was concentrating on the instrument in a different way, where like I have no choice but to correct this mistake. I have no choice. But the nerves got me. So I could have probably played in my bedroom with nobody watching a lot better. But in front of those people, I sucked. And so I made a deal with myself that, like, if I can keep up this practice regimen and I'm not 1,000 times better by this time next year, then I'll quit. So that was, like, the thing. And like, because of embarrassments, because of bombing, because of all that stuff, that's the only way that I get good. And that's why, you know, it's funny. I've written all these songs and records and all that stuff, but the only reason I do it is because if I don't, I look like a real jerk.
Well, that
because I said I was gonna.
That yeah. Also, like, being accountable to people is yeah. good. And then, yeah. And then on top of that, it's you know, everyone will bomb, but it's then like, what do you do with that? And some people would have taken that guitar case and been like,
yeah,
that's the end of you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was fun.
Yep.
Bye. Good riddance.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's that bombing that I think that sets things in motion. And also, the truth is that nobody really gives a shit. You can bomb and make the whole room feel uncomfortable, and they kind of avert their eyes as they walk out and they see you there. Hey, thanks for coming. Yeah. And you've like made everyone feel weird as they're exiting. But
is that how you get them back?
That's how I got them back. Guys, listen, I realized I was kind of weird up on stage. But you know, a year or two from then, you know, no one's going to really care unless you really like implode on stage or something like that.
Well, I've also found that you can also bomb gracefully.
Yeah.
So that even if people aren't laughing or they don't get what you're doing, if you don't freak out,
yeah,
then they're fine with it. Like you, yeah. And you know, they're not going to say you were the funniest comic.
You were right.
But you
yeah.
could still leave the stage and be likable just by
right.
like, ah, you know, I thought this would work and it didn't, but all right, you know,
yeah.
whatever. And then if you're fine with it, then they will have a natural inclination to be like, oh, I guess it's okay. Like what they're feeling is the sort of dissonance between. They're feeling your internal dissonance when you freak out, when you bomb.
Absolutely.
And it reminds them of that they hate feeling that way.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
They go
yeah.
from a crowd full of people that are being led down this journey to yeah. a bunch of people who have a mirror in front of them like, oh, this is like that nightmare I always have.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you're making
yeah.
them feel it.
Absolutely.
So if you don't freak out about it, they
I know, yeah.
about it, even if they're not laughing.
Yeah, I remember learning that. I remember asking somebody when I first started out in comedy. It's so strange in comedy. That was the biggest difference between music and comedy that I learned was that you can throw a rock and hit 400 guitar players who are not going to ever work in their life. You start doing comedy and people from the networks come out immediately and you have to avoid them to not be seen too early. I remember people from Fox were coming out to the comedy studio and I remember I was like, I'm not going to perform. That's a Fox rep, and I'm just starting out, and I suck. I mean, I know. I've been up there. I hear what's not happening, you know? And I remember asking her at the time. I said, well, I'm sure you get this question all the time, but what are you looking for when you see a comic? And she goes, at this point, I'm looking for someone who can bomb comfortably.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Wow.
And that was it. And then I remembered also my buddy Bill Broaddus, who wrote with me on Home Movies. He's also a writer on Dr. Katz. He had a great story about the audience not being with him and getting on Letterman as a comic, because he went to do a show and basically the audience, the camera only sees the performer. They don't have like a crane sweeping over the audience and all that stuff when you're just like at some club taping for a show. And so he knew that they were taping that night and he just said, I'm going to fuck this shit. There's nobody here. No one's laughing at anything. I'm up next. I'm going to act like I'm doing really well. And he did. He acted like he did really well. And he's, you know, and just like sat back there after and just like paused like where the big moments would be and swaggered and really enjoyed every moment. But he had that confidence and then he got booked.
Wow.
Holy shit.
But he said it was because he pretended that he was doing well, you know.
Wow.
And I remember that stage fright that I had back then would follow me to, you know, stand up and all that stuff. You have to really confront it. And I remember watching people, and I thought, okay, I'm not relaxed on stage. I can't think clearly. But I see people that do, so how does a relaxed person stand? So if you start faking this relaxed thing, you put the audience in the mood of relaxation, even though on the inside you're like jittery or weird or whatever it is in those early days of stand-up. So I remember just going, oh, I see this guy. He looks like the most relaxed comic on stage. What is he doing with his arm? Now, okay, he's walking over. I just remember watching all that stuff. Yeah. And just trying
so they're getting getting visual cues. But the other thing that, yeah. that does is that you can sort of reverse engineer your body, where usually you sort of, I think people assume that their emotions drive their body language.
Right.
But if you do, like you're saying, if you
start
if you assume,
yeah.
then it sends messages back to your brain that you're okay,
yeah.
and it actually does affect your
yeah,
mood.
You may be right. And also, yeah, that's like the actor's breathing thing and all that stuff. Eventually you start breathing slower. It's almost like if you work out and you're like, you're yeah. breathing really fast and you go, hey, idiot, breathe slower. And you start breathing slower, then all of a sudden you start relaxing and you're not as exhausted as you were.
Yeah.
Stupid stuff like that.
So what do you have coming out?
What I'm out promoting is when I wanted to do this rock opera thing, I thought, again, just like every opportunity that I have where I get paid to do it, I consider that to possibly be my last one. Like they're going to be on to me and it's going to stop. So if I'm going to do a rock opera, I want to do it right. I want to get a 50-piece orchestra to play with me. So I talked to Barry McCreary, who does the music. He just won
for Walking Dead.
Walking Dead, yeah. Yes. And he just won an Emmy for Da Vinci's Demons, I think. And he did Battlestar Galactica, and he also does Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So he's a super talented guy, and he and I met, and he was a fan of the music of Death Clock on the show. And so he was asking me like how I arrange guitars and all kinds of stuff like that, and I'd listen to his stuff. So we ended up doing a benefit concert for like an AIDS benefit on Freddie Mercury's the anniversary of his death like 2 years ago at the Roxy, and we had 3 guitarists and 11 vocalists.
Oh, wow.
And we did all of our favorite songs, and I had the best seat in the house because I had 2 great guitar players with me on either side, and we were doing these 3-part harmonies that you hear from like Flash Gordon to everything that you've ever wanted to do, good old-fashioned Lover Boy, just amazing solos and all that stuff. And I'm sitting in between these 2 loud amps going, this is what it must have... Brian May never got to do this because he was only 1 guitarist live, so we wanted it to sound like the record. And that was our whole thing, and it sounded so great. And we don't get to do it that often because everyone does everything for free if it's a benefit, but if it's not a benefit, no one can afford that many musicians on stage. So I said, hey, listen, I want to find out how much this costs. Do you have like a budget breakdown? And Barry McCreary has like a whole team of people, and he goes, well, if you want X amount, it's going to cost this much. If you want this, it's going to cost that much. And he gave me these different demarcation points of... And I finally said, okay, I think if I'm going to do this, I'm going to put out a record, and I think the network's kind of like finances would only cover a small amount, so I think I'm going to pay for a lot of this stuff myself because I want the experience. Even if it goes tits up, I'll learn something, and it's going to sound really good. And if I ever want to get into film scoring or anything, I'll have this whole reel of stuff. But ultimately, I think it's going to be cool and worth it. So I decided to get together with him, and he arranged. He took my ideas and made them way cooler and gave some voices to different instruments where I had them on, like, different land, French horns doing something. He put something in the cello instead.
Oh, wow.
But I have the whole score there, and it was really cool to see how he worked. And he is just an amazing professional, easy to work with, and works really quickly. It does insanely good stuff. So that was a really cool thing to do. And then to involve these other vocalists too. His wife sang on it, Bear's wife Rhea, and she has an amazing voice. So any of the female vocals you hear on the Doomstar Requiem, which is what it's called, a clock opera, you'll hear her. And then like I said, we had these other cool people like Jack Black came up and sang a few things, and he was great, so easy to work with, and just a great pitch, just amazing pitch, and does not mess around, or he's just good. And powerful. Cannibal Corpse, George Corpse Grinder Fisher, came and sang. You can hear it when it's him. It's scary. It's extra scary sounding. And that was the idea. So I thought, I'm going to put out this special, because it only airs once, really, and then I'll air it a few other times. But this music has to be really cool, and I have to like it a lot. And I get to add all these different kinds of elements of music, not just metal, because the way I thought about it, which is the way I think about the music on the show, is there only can be one metal moment if it's like wall-to-wall crazy, like, you know, loud and dark. You're doing that the whole time, your ear's just going to tune out, you know, even though it's loud and crazy. So you have to counterbalance that with really quiet moments and kind of symphonic stuff and whatever. So I figured that's what I'm going to do with this. I'm going to have start off with this big epic fanfare and then go into rock and further into metal and then contradict every other song stylistically to keep your ear alert and to want to go back and listen and hear the story and all that stuff.
So that's available.
That's now available on iTunes and on my website, brendansmall.com. And there's a libretto that you can download and follow along with. So it's the whole story. It's basically the script of the whole thing that you can check that out. And there's like a featurette with me working with all the actors, like Malcolm McDowell and all that stuff, and getting them to sing and finding their pitches and all that stuff. It was pretty funny, yeah. And Mark Hamill's in it too.
Yeah.
But yeah, pretty awesome.
So what do you think is the? Well, and you're going to play a couple things.
I can play them on guitar, or you can play some tracks of this stuff if you want to. We'll
either or.
Yeah.
Kyle, I have to send you on an errand.
Yes.
My meter's about to expire. Do you know where? So I'll tell you where to go. Just turn right out of here, go past the DMV up Formosa, and it's the first like street.
With the meters on it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And I'm on the other side of the street. Just max it out.
John and I totally have tickets.
Max it out. $30,000.
30 grand. No.
That's like your spot then.
Yeah, it's my fucking spot.
There's a Lefty 63 Strat at Guitar Center. It's
$23,000. Guitar Center. There won't be prices like this until next Tuesday.
Yeah, you know what? Do you have a way to play tracks on the show?
We can drop them in afterwards.
Yeah, that's what I figured. Maybe I'll set up a couple things for you to check out.
That'd be great.
And I can play you like a riff of one of the songs. But it was a fun process because I had the idea for this thing. And it is a story. You have to go story first, you know. You can't just start writing the music. You have to like have the story mapped out. So I got together with two other writers, Janine DiTullio, who used to write on Conan back in the day. And then she was on Home Movies as a voice actor. And she's just a really great writer, just a great structure person and stuff. And then Mark Brooks, who's been a writer and director on the show for a long time. And we sat in a room, just the three of us, and I just kind of pitched this whole thing, you know, and I knew what the top of it was. I knew what this big section was with the there's a big flashback in the thing, and I'll probably set that up. Actually, I am setting it up. Are you guys still recording and all that stuff?
Yeah. You still recording.
Yeah. So the whole thing started with this idea that the story is a rescue story. That's the whole thing. It's this big kind of like I wanted to take we left the last season with the abduction of a guitarist and a love interest of a lead singer. And what I wanted to do is have a kind of an action. Like it's a hero's journey very much. Like every single thing is completely based off of the Joseph Campbell stuff. Like his outline. It's a three-act thing. And it's about it's basically in the hero's journey, the hero gets the call, and then you know you set up status quo, and you get the call, which means like the invitation into the adventure, and then the hero has to negate that and say no, I'm not ready, my life is fine, and then he has to go to a point of no return where it's like in Star Wars, Luke wants to hang out in Dagobah, then he goes home and he sees his family's been burned. And so he has no choice but to follow him. So we have that all that stuff. But what I wanted to do was add this other part where we went to a flashback of how the abducted guitarist actually got into the band in the first place. And that's where I decided, wouldn't it be cool if I had like a 2-minute long guitar solo somewhere in the middle of a TV special? I haven't seen that before. But it has to be cool, and the stakes have to keep raising every kind of moment of this duel. And what happens is the lead guitarist makes a deal with the band because their ex-guitarist just quit. This isn't a flashback. Their ex-guitarist just quit, and they need the band's like, well, we got to replace him so we can make our first record. And he says, I'll make you a deal. If see all these like 300, 2,000 whatever auditioners out here, if I can beat them all, then I'm gonna be. Let's be a one guitar band like Deep Purple or something like that. I don't need a second guitar. I don't need that to compete with somebody else's ego. Let's make this a one guitar band. And they say fine, so they make a deal, and there's a song where he just beats all these guitarists. And finally the young guitar player shows up late and sings a song about being from Norway and and he got lost along the way, and he has like a little fanny pack and a guitar, like he must have sewn himself a guitar gig bag, you know, that has like Norwegian kind of like decoration on it and stuff. and his guitar is covered in duct tape, and it's been dropped like 1,000 times. He's been living on the streets. And the guitarist says, "All right, fine, I'll let you. You know, your time has come and gone, but you seem like a nice guy. It's a shame you have to go down this way. Get ready, let's play." And we have this big kind of tete-a-tete between guitars, and that's a song called "The Duel." So if you want to cue that up.
Yeah,
so you'll have that. But it's a really fun piece, and visually it's a really cool thing because you have to advance every piece of music visually, too. You have to raise the stakes with everything as it keeps going. And the guitarist blows the last note. He does everything perfectly except for the last note. And then the guitarist hires him anyway because he says, no one's challenged me in that way before. So it's a fun, so I started out with that first. I thought, wouldn't it be cool to see in the show, these two guitarists, one of them is always shitting on the other guitarist, but you don't realize that he's the one that hired him the whole time. So, so it was a nice little thing. There's a lot of like emotional
what
points
is this,
in this
what
stuff.
What does this mean? Well, what time do they come in?
They're coming in at
3:30. Oh, 3:30? Yeah. Like 2 minutes, 3:30?
Yeah, a couple of minutes.
And that's that's the idea. That's a riff from the beginning of the flashback. So you'll hear that. There's a lot of Metallica, old Metallica in it. And that's the kind of the idea, is to go a little bit old school with that stuff.
Well, now that we realize there's someone else coming into the rehearsal space at
yes.
Swing House, I'll tell you what. Will you? Can you just give us a some type of death clock? Enjoy your burrito song at the end.
Absolutely. Okay. Enjoy your burrito.
Enjoy your burrito.
Brendan Small! Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank
you, guys.
Brendan Small.
Is disbanded. One of them was taken.
We look to the skies to watch a new star awaken.
Oh, the doom star is born. Oh, the deadly light. And the star will turn to blood on this prophet's night. And the prophecy has warned us that one of us must die. Before this is all over, one of us must die.
You know.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.